This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following production is part of the We Be Geeks podcast collective.
From days long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend.
The dream that came through a million years, that lived on through all the tears.
It came here, the Fandom Nexus.
Fabulous secret powers were revealed to our host as he plugged in his microphone.
I have a podcast!
Here he is, your Spider-Pan, Jeremy.
All right, we are here. We are here. We've got two, two panels this weekend. So Philip and I, your Spider-Pan is here on location. I didn't get to bring my big, well, that'll cost us. Oh, hey, there's William there, dressed as old Luke.
Oh, I love it.
But yeah,
I wanted to find one.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, of course, you know, don't take photos over there, but the guy dressed as old Luke, William, he used to be a police officer in Overland Park. He moved to San Diego. He's the head guy in the 501st. He's pretty important. For a while, they had a lightsaber training thing that I was doing. Heather and I were doing that. He was a part of that as well. So, yeah, we're going to see a lot of costumes there. I think Philip's noticing the costumes. But we just got onto the floor. We're going to wander. I'm going to buy some stuff.
Fun stuff.
Find Celebrity Row.
This is like a nerd's Christmas.
I love it.
Yeah. And it's been 4 years.
Yeah, 4 years.
Four years.
Gotten to come to one. Last time I came, just so you'll know, I mean, I don't know if you need to know, but I had just come out of three brain surgeries and had just been released. And that's when I got to, William Shatner did the sweetest, kindest thing. Him and his people. I was in a wheelchair and I just had my head worked on and they had allowed me to get my picture taken with him and they didn't charge me a thing. So I'm going to go meet him again today. And this time I'm ready to get my picture with him. And
you've booked the time at 7:30.
Yes, I did. Yes, but I'm excited about it. I'm really excited about it. So I am very thankful to get to be here today. And even though it's hard to walk around and all for me, I'm very excited. This is fun. This is the first time I got to do anything like this in a while.
Yeah. 4 years, and the last time I was here was the last time I was hosting a panel. And but we're back. We're post-COVID. Mm-hmm. Let's go find some adventure.
Yes.
And maybe get some photos with some stuff.
Absolutely. I want to see Vader just for a second.
All right, I have a great panel recording that I want to share with you. But before we share with it, I have to say I goofed up and I forgot to actually turn on the recorder at the beginning of the panel. My fault. So I want to real quick kind of just introduce who was with us. We had Summer Nesbitt from the Walt Disney Hometown Museum in Marceline had come down to be a part of this panel. And so you miss a little bit of the beginning of it. So let me just run over some of the information. We mentioned the Disney family coming in June of 1911 to Kansas City after Elias has sold the farm. We talked about the house over on Bellefontaine. I told people where it was and how life changed for Walt and Roy as they had paper routes to work on that Elias had purchased for the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times. And Walt attending Benton Elementary, and in 1916, Walt began attending Saturday classes at the Kansas City Art Institute. We do talk a little bit about Walt, the Disney family moving to Chicago August 1917, and then Walt driving an ambulance in World War I, serving 9 months in France as part of the Red Cross, where his mother had to fictionalize his ID to help him get in there and do that, and how he started drawing on his ambulance and then drew on other people's ambulances, and then coming back to Kansas City and getting a job. And I think this is about the point where I hit the button where he meets Ub Iwerks. And as we get into the actual panel, you are now going to hear from Sumner Nesbitt. But here at the panel, of course, you have me, your Spider-Pan Jeremy, Lost Boy Philip, also known as the Kryptonian. And that's pretty much what you missed in the introduction. But here we go. Let's hear our first panel from Friday at Planet Comic-Con, Kansas City.
But he did meet somebody there that became very important to his life, both personally and professionally, and that was Ub Iwerks. Now, Ub Iwerks was Walt's first business partner. Ub Iwerks is from Kansas City, and he also was working as an artist with Pesman Rubin. And when they both got laid off, they decided, well, they'll just go into business for themselves. And so they started their own company called Disney Iwerks, and then they reversed it, called Iwerks Disney, or maybe it was... It was Iwerks Disney, and then they reversed it to Disney Iwerks, but they reversed it at some point in time because they were concerned that it sounded too much like an eye doctor, an optometrist. And so,
so it was probably eye first.
That's
Yeah.
So anyway, but after not really a lot of success doing that, they then both got jobs working for the Kansas City Film Ad Company, which at the time was the Kansas City Slide Company. And what they did then was they actually drew ads and things like that that would go before movies and things like that that would play just like these little still film, you know, just as it's called, the Kansas City Slide Company. They were just slides that would, you know, they would put in front of a projector. And so they both started doing that, and that got Walt into the realm of the theater owners in town.
Yeah.
And so that's when he really started to figure out what animation was and the things that he could do with moving animation, not just still photos. So while he was working at the Kansas City Film Ad Company, he actually met a few other people that would be really important to his animation career, and that's Hugh Harmon, also his brother Fred Harmon, both animators, and then Rudolf Ising, and then of course he met someone named Carl Stalling. Now Carl Stalling, not an animator, but just as important as the rest of them. Yeah. Carl Stalling was actually a film composer, and he actually got his start as the organist at the Isis Theater here in Kansas City. So back in the day when they had silent films, they used to have an organist live there playing the music while the film was running. And so that's what Carl Stalling did.
Yeah. Now, keep these names in mind because we're going to have to jump into details. Like Hugh Harmon, Rudolf Ising, they're eventually going to form a business together. And Carl Stalling, who here is a fan of Looney Tunes? You've seen his name. You've heard his music. He's all over that. But we'll get into some more details on that later. So, like, I kind of name drop a few people in these early stuff. But when we get into what happened to these guys, that's kind of the meat and potatoes when we get to it. And the funny part is, I forgot to hit record, so we just, the first thing I got, so y'all get something special that the people who listen regularly to the podcast are not going to ever hear. They won't know that the conspiracy that we launched at the beginning of the show, where we're all going to go out there and we're just going to start taking every toy that's in every aisle up there. Come on, work with me, right? Okay, anyway. So the Left Graham Studios, actually from May 1922. Now, some of you may have seen the building. I haven't seen it since a car drove into it. But yeah, September 22, they signed their first contract with Pictorial Clubs Incorporated to produce 6 cartoons. And December 1922, almost at 2022, my goodness, they completed 6 fairy tale cartoons. In May of 1923, Walt pitches the Alice comedies to Margaret J. Winkler in New York. Now, those of you who are big Disney fans, I bet you're like, the Alice comedies, I've heard of that, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, we got like some.
Maybe 3 of us.
Some of these are already in public domain. You can actually go and find a lot of these online if you go digging around. Even Wikipedia isn't allowed to show an old Alice comedy. This actually had a little girl from, I believe she was from Kansas, as Alice. It's one of the earliest times, I think maybe even one of the first times, you're going to see a live-action person with an animated character. So before there was Roger Rabbit, and before, who was it that danced with Jerry Mouse?
That Gene Kelly. Kelly. Yeah.
Before Gene Kelly danced with Jerry Mouse, you had this little girl, Alice, and there's even this nice little shot where Walt is taking the Alice over, and he's drawing things on a thing and showing her, look at this wonderful world I'm creating, and eventually Alice is going to go inside the wonderful world that Walt creates. They're really, really kind of fun and cute. Do you guys get to show any of those at the museum?
Yeah, we do. We actually we have it on a repeat on a loop. We show Alice's Wonderland, which was the first Alice comedy that was made, which was actually filmed here in Kansas City.
They were starting, and before that, they just started with Fleischer cartoons.
Or Fleischer?
Fleischer cartoons. Yeah. They just started those cartoons. They had that clown, I can't remember his name, the ink, what was it? Coco. Yeah, oh, and yeah. they had it in the inkwell. And that's when you first started having your real life and cartoon come together situation. Then right after that, you had Alice, and all these mm-hmm. things were coming together.
Very and if the Fleischer cartoons sound familiar to you, they did some early Superman cartoons very that first. Are really cool. They're actually the ones Popeye. That are the reason why Superman flies, because in the original comic, Superman just leapt over tall buildings with a single bound, but it's hard to animate that. And so when he jumped, he looked like he was taking off and flying. So they eventually talked to DC Comics at the time and said, can we just say that he flies? And then...
Also, the reason why the first time they ever heard him say, you know, faster, I mean, the first time he said America, you know, truth, America, American
truth, justice,
way.
The American way.
Yeah, because it used to be the truth, justice, and then eventually it said in the American way, because they needed that at that time. Everybody needed that with wars and all that going on, yeah. So they needed to hear that.
Now, the odd thing, though, about this, so here in May, we got the Alice comedies.
Can I ask
we have a quick question.
It is.
It is. The old ones are now officially public domain, so you can find and watch them
on YouTube.
On YouTube. Yeah. I actually have a short documentary that I didn't bring with me that I actually used clips of it because I can get away with it. So, but the weird thing, so like in May, he gets the Alice comedies, but then August that same year, Laugh-O-Gram goes bankrupt. So Walt moves to California. Mm. Now, that's actually beneficial for a lot of things, but it just also, you know, it's one of those things, like, you know, we could have had all this animation that was coming out of Kansas City if this had succeeded because of the artists that he had working with him. But maybe if he hadn't gone to California and everything that happens next, where he meets up with Roy and pulls Roy out of a tuberculosis bed and says, hey, I don't know how to run a business. And they start the Walt Disney Company. I think he had went over. They had some of their other brothers that were. Wasn't there another brother in California at the time too, or is it just Roy?
Yeah. So at the time when Walt first moved to California, it was just Roy there. However, much like how Walt got all of his animator buddies that were here in Kansas City to move out to California, Walt got all of his brothers and the rest of his family to move out to California as well over time. you know, something that's significant. When Walt first built his studio, he wanted it to be run as the way a family would run it. And so he, you know, hung out with all of his buddies. He wanted all of his friends involved. You know, they would hang out there at the studio long hours after they actually stopped working. And, you know, that was just sort of the environment that Walt wanted to create. And you know, he just liked to have all of those people that were close to him around him, you know, whenever he could. Yeah. So, yeah, so all of his friends he made here in Kansas City, all of his animator friends, he convinced them to move to California. And he did the same with his actual real family as well.
Yeah, Walt knew talent when he met him. I mean, there's people that worked at the Disney studios that would talk about Walt would come up with things for them to do. They thought, that's not what I'm good at. But then they start doing it. It's like, oh, actually, I am good at this. I don't know how Walt did it, but he could find your talent, what you're good at, and you would excel at it. He just knew these things. I don't know how.
I like to think he had a sense of magic to him. That's how I like to think about it.
Disney magic. And so, like, all these people that he's met, that he's bringing with him. Okay, now I've got some details on some of these. We mentioned Hugh Harmon earlier. I've even got his birthday, August 31st, 1903, in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. So after Laugh-O-Gram, he actually tried to start his own studio with Carmen Maxwell and Rudolph Ising. You're going to have to remember him later, Harmon and Ising. Has anyone ever heard of harmonizing? Oh, yeah, we got a guy.
Harmonizing.
They started their own thing. But they failed, though, at this first one. He returned to work with Walt under Charles Mintz. We're going to get that notorious name later. Mintz kept him after sending Walt home without Oswald, which I think we're going to get in more detail on that one probably too. I think I did a lot more focus on my notes of some of the other people, but y'all probably know about Oswald the Lucky Rabbit and the unlucky story of how he was taken away, but then later traded for Al Michaels. So Disney now has Oswald back for a sportscaster. But yeah, Charles Mintz, when Walt had moved to California, he starts making these Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, which I think some of those are in public domain now too, so you can find some of those.
Some are.
Well, the original ones made by Walt are owned by Disney now.
Okay.
So
so they do have control. And they're actually doing stuff with Oswald. I actually found a nice little plush of Oswald in a Disney tour long ago. It was nice. It was so nice when they got him back because they were able to do something.
I was thrilled to see him in that game. What was that game that he was in?
Oh, Epic Mickey.
Yes.
The Epic Mickey games.
I was thrilled to see him again.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I had that big book and that came out in, I want to say 1980, maybe 79, but my father had a copy of the book. It's mine now, but I look at it every once in a while. I remember it would show Walt's early stuff in Kansas City and all this, and it showed this rabbit, and I said, Dad, who's that? He goes, well, son, he said, Walt, before Mickey Mouse, God had made, Walt, not God, okay? I apologize, I'm a pastor, I'm used to talking about God, okay? Anyway, he said, and my dad was a pastor too. Anyway, he said, Walt had made Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And I said, so how come we don't get to watch him now? And he said to me, he said, people are jerks. He goes,
Charles
that's just
Mintz.
How it is.
Charles Mintz. They let's see. Did I have how many? Yeah. He continued. Charles Mintz actually was producing Oswald cartoons with Ising. They developed a particular style that they actually carried over to Warner Brothers. So, you know, a lot of those early Warner Brothers, some of that Oswald style. Although I guess it probably wasn't quite the same without Walt being in there.
Yeah. Well, you know, Oswald never really had that sustainable career that Mickey had later on.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, after Walt's involvement was gone from the Oswald cartoons, I think the Oswald cartoons kind of lost their charm a little bit. So,
yeah.
And they kind of lost their popularity as well. So.
Yeah. But, you know, Hugh Harmon did a lot of other things with Ising and a few other Disney animators. He actually went on with Leon Schlesinger. All right, who's my Looney Tunes people again? Every Looney Tune you've ever seen, Leon Schlesinger, you have seen his name on it. He created actually first the pilot for Bosco, the Talk Inc. Kid, when he was under contract for Warner Brothers. So this is,
Bosco!
You know, we're still talking about Rudolph Ising and, of course, Hugh Harmon doing this. In 1939, while working for MGM, he was nominated for an Oscar for his anti-war Peace on Earth cartoon. We're still, of course, just to make sure this is all the Hugh Harmon notes I've got. So this is Hugh Harmon's career. And this was actually, the Peace on Earth cartoon was two squirrels, and they had commentary on the evils of humanity, because squirrels are watching us. They know what we do. That's what I'm thinking.
If you don't think so, just try to drive down the road and not have a million of them jump in front of you.
So what's cool is Hugh Harmon, in 1940, actually produced Hanna-Barbera's first cartoon, Puss Gets the Boots. And that introduced the world to Tom and Jerry.
That's right.
So maybe without Walt Disney, we don't get Tom and Jerry. I don't know. I can't say that definitively, but that's in my headcanon, okay? 1941, he left MGM and joined with Disney veteran Mel Shaw to form their own studio in Ub Iwerks' old studio, and they created military training cartoons. Mm-hmm. Next guy on my list, Fred Harmon. He was, of course, from the ad company. He was born in 1902. He actually became known after the Laugh-O-Gram for Red Ryder comic strips.
I love it.
Does this sound familiar to anybody? Anybody shoot their eye out?
That's right.
Okay.
That's how we
got. So if it wasn't for Walt, you would not shoot your eye out, okay?
You had more than just a gun. You had Red Ryder bread. You had Red Ryder toys and comics. You had so many Red Ryder things. They had Red Ryder shorts that they'd show in movie theaters. I have a lot of junk about Red Ryder, believe me, but I won't talk about that now.
Now, all right, we've already talked about his buddy, Rudolph Ising. I got a lot of history on Rudolph Ising. You want to jump to you? You want to
sure.
go on for my next notes?
Let's see. Where's it at here?
Yeah, it's on the next page over.
Okay.
Starting with, he actually tried to create his own studio, and he failed at that. So he went back with his buddy Harmon to work with Disney on Oswald cartoons and Alice comedies.
Says he continued working with Mintz after Oswald had taken was taken away from Walt. And after leaving the Universal Studios, that's where Mintz was, after leaving Universal Studios, he and Harmon went to Warner Brothers and began work on Bosco, which launched the Looney Tunes series. Now, I had seen some of those Bosco cartoons. I have them with my Looney Tunes collection that I had bought. They have a little bit of Bosco on there. Now, if there's any Seinfeld fans here, anybody a Seinfeld fan? Anybody at all? Now, you all know the name or word Bosco. We're not supposed to know that. That is the secret word for George to get into his account. You know that, so don't tell anyone. Okay. And also, it's the wonderful chocolatey syrup drink, which you can still find in certain places. Anyway, so... where am I here? So Bosco was to launch the Looney Tunes series. It also started Merry Melodies and parody of Walt Disney's Silly Symphonies.
Or he might just have been utilizing the popularity.
Mm-hmm.
I can't confirm it as a parody, but come on. Walt comes out, gets successful Silly Symphonies. Next thing you know, this guy who used to work with Walt decides, well, we're going to make Merry Melodies. I know, we'll go even call them Looney Tunes. It's the same setup.
That is a fact, mm-hmm. But they also had there was a few others. I don't remember them all right now, but they'd have different things for tunes and melodies, mm-hmm. And there's a couple of those I don't remember right now.
Yeah, when Hugh Harmon and Rudolph Ising formed the Harmonizing, they started doing, I forgot what they called theirs. I think it's probably in here somewhere. But they started doing based on music, because that's, you know, part of the fun of like those early animations is like once they could have sound and animation. And I don't know if anybody had even thought about it, because, you know, when they see a live action, it's like, oh, well, we know live things make sound. But when you see something animated, it doesn't make sound on its own. So I think that's probably what gave Mickey the biggest push in the world, is like when he had sound and animation. And that was huge around here. Now, Walt was not the extreme first to put sound on animation, but he worked on it and makes it better. That's a lot of what Walt would do is he would find things, and then he's like, how can we make this a little bit better? Even animatronics, I forgot where he went. Wasn't he in South America where he found this little bird? And he saw like the little motion when you push some buttons on it, and he brought it home to his what would be basically Imagineers and say, how can we make this better, and how can we make this and put it in the park?
I think he went to a place called the Tiki 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 Room. I'm pretty sure.
That's pretty much where we got the Tiki Room, but yeah. I'm sidetracking way off of stuff, but yeah, I mean, it's like, it's just wild how all these different people, everybody who Walt came in contact with, that he worked with, went on to do great things. And an amazing stuff is they all worked here in Kansas City. And why does nobody know this?
I don't know, but there's a lot more to Kansas City.
Yeah, there's so much more.
More than just barbecue sauce. Okay.
Anyway, where did I take you off on there?
They are frequent. They are frequent, accused of copying Disney. Oh, you already said it. Copying Disney style and parody title may have something to do with it. They worked on Silly Symphony's Mer-babies, while Walt's animators worked on Snow White. In 1931, Merry Melodies, Smile, Darn You, Smile.
All right. See, now, last time I actually did present this information, I tried to get a sing-along going for Smile, Darn You, Smile. Y'all seen Roger Rabbit, right? You know the song at the end, right?
Smile, darn you, smile.
You know this whole world is a great world after all.
But they're not.
Nobody knows this.
Wow.
Okay. Go watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's at the end of the day. All the characters come out and sing along. It's Smile, Darn You, Smile. It was actually, I can't remember where the song actually originated from.
But it's a.
Should we pose for the camera?
Says drawn by how you say it? I Freeling?
I Freeling, which you might know him from some Looney Tunes as well. Also known as Friz Freeling.
And Max Maxwell, who we will meet later.
Yes.
Go ahead, take it.
Yeah, I have a lot of stuff in here. You want to talk about like 1933?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, after Leon Schlesinger had a falling out with Warner Brothers, he took Bosco over to MGM with Harmon and Ising as well. And then they kind of saw what happened with Walt and Oswald, and they didn't really want the same thing to happen to them. You know, something that's really important.
Well, this is particularly the Rudolph Ising had the falling out with Leon Schlesinger while at Warner Brothers.
Yeah, and so the important thing to note is when Walt had that falling out with Charles Mintz and he lost the rights to Oswald, he said he would never do another cartoon again that he didn't have the rights to. And so I think all of the animators that experienced that, you know, learned from that as well. And so
no, that's my character. Thank you. I'm taking him.
Yeah. And so Harmon and Ising, you know, obviously wanted to keep their characters to themselves if they possibly could. So so they took Bosco over to MGM. While they were there, they created the Happy Harmonies, which is another version.
That's what I was trying to think of, the Happy Harmonies.
Another version of the Merry Melodies or Silly Symphonies or, you know, another.
But the quality of them, if you ever see those Happy Harmonies, the quality is, I mean, you can tell that they picked up a lot of their quality and style from Walt with working with him and the quality he expected. Those are amazing. Those early MGM cartoons, they're really hard to find these days, but I definitely recommend them. They're just beautiful animation. They really are.
Yeah. Well, and after they started that series, they were actually terminated from MGM a little bit later on. In which case, Rudolph Ising went back and did a little bit of work for Disney and on the Silly Symphonies, and then he actually went back to MGM for a little bit as well. There was actually a couple cartoons that he ended up selling to Fred Quimby, who Fred Quimby was instrumental with the Tom and Jerry cartoons later on. But he actually, Rudolph Ising won an Oscar for the short film The Milky Way. It was actually the first time they had that category at the Academy Awards that Walt Disney didn't win the Academy Award for that. Yeah.
That's a great cartoon. I want all those.
So Rudolph Ising actually kind of gave up animation for a little bit because he actually went and served during World War II. Mm. Obviously him and Hugh Harmon did eventually part ways, and, you know, he had all that, you know, kind of career on his own. They actually did another short in 1951 called Good Wrinkles, which was to support the California prune industry, which I think is kind of interesting.
That's kind of wondering if when they were doing the California raisins. Some of y'all are so young, you probably don't know the California raisins, but I wondered if this prune Good Wrinkles another gave somebody the idea, like, hey, you know what? That worked for prunes. Maybe we need to do it for California raisins. I wonder about
these
things.
Did you hear it through the grapevine?
I heard it through the grapevine. Not much, but I stumbled over that mess that lineup, didn't I? Y'all know what I was saying, though.
Sure.
But, okay, now this is the fun part. With Carl Stalling, we were talking about him and some of his music. He actually born in Lexington, Missouri in 1888. So, I mean, he's like good deal older than Walt even. But actually, at a very young age, he was playing on a broken toy piano. Can you imagine Schroeder
from
Peanuts? That's pretty much, that's Carl Stalling. This guy was just musical from the
I have a feeling it's because of him that we, that any of us know any of the classic music. Because I honestly, people say, do you like any classic music? And I used to say this, and it's not the way it is now. I don't like classical music. Exactly. I don't know. I don't like classical music, I used to think. And then someone, oh, you've heard of this one and this one. No, I've never heard that. And then suddenly they start playing it. And as they start to play it, I was like, oh, I know that. That's the one where Daffy Duck is running away from, you know. Or that's the one where Mickey is running from the lawnmower that's causing a storm and all this junk. The fact of the matter is, it's because they would put that, or he would put that, in those cartoons.
What is that famous, is it something like called The Machine or something? It's the one that you would always say, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, or, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was actually a pretty famous piece at the time. But see, the brilliance of using some of those pieces is they would actually get what would be popular music at the time, and they would stick it into the cartoons, and there's, you know, that music recognition. It's, it was pretty brilliant, but if it went to one of those, most likely Carl Stalling composed it himself. But we already mentioned before, you know, like that, you know, Carl Stalling actually, for the Laugh-O-Gram cartoons, was playing the music. He actually met Walt at the Isis Theater. But I have a long, stinking list of all the stuff he did after Laugh-O-Gram. But some of the fun, he actually did dub Mickey's voice once.
Oh, really?
Yes. I found that, but I could not find the exact thing. But what was neat is he actually developed a technique that's called ticking. And that's where you have orchestra members wearing headphones to hear a metronome beat, keeping them all on the same beat. Now, there's a great documentary at the museum. What is the Man, the Myth, the Legend, something like that. I forgot the name.
The Man Behind the Myth.
But you can see a little bit of Walt and all these musicians and sound people trying to put sound to like stuff like Steamboat Willie. And you had to do it all in one take. There is not the layering that you can do now. I mean, right now, I've got a recorder. I can do up to four different tracks, and I can edit it. But they had to do it all at once, and so they would have to have it timed exactly right with the composition of the music, which would be part of your sound effects. It's one of the things the Disney cartoons were famous for is a lot of the sound effects, like when water splashes, it might be a cymbal crash instead of sounding like water. You know, like Donald Duck falls in the water, and cymbals. They used music for stuff. So you kind of see where this ends up coming around, where the ticking, where it's like, okay, we need to make sure all the music are in time, and we have to have a rhythm to this animation. So you metronome all your people to make sure you're exactly in rhythm, so you can just play the music and have it fit to the animation, which is pretty brilliant. So that's probably why I think Warner Brothers had so much fun with him. But he also did work on Flip the Frog Schwartz with Ub Iwerks. I've never seen any of these.
Oh, I've seen a few.
But
well done.
I have a long list. When he started working over at Warner Brothers and doing the, he was the music director for the animation department. It said his arrival coincided with the emergence of the golden age of Warner Animation under supervision from Leon Schlesinger. He assembled the crack team of animators, including Robert McKimson, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones. Y'all got to know Chuck Jones,
Chuck
man.
Jones.
He's the man. Tex Avery, one of the greats and everything, and Frank Tashlin. And the studio's cartoons, the Merry Melodies, the Looney Tunes series, respectively, heralded a new era of inspired lunacy with stable of memorable characters, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, and all of them. Mm-hmm. Overall, Stalling scored about 600 cartoons over in all, and he's even he has that distinctive boing sound effect, apparently like the beginning of a, like when you watch a Looney Tune and you got that boing. That's all Carl Stalling. He's like credited for that. I think he even let's see, oh, here it is. Yes, he's also established the distinctive theme songs used in the Merrily We Roll Along for Merry Melodies series and the Merry Go Round Broke Down for Looney Tunes. Once again, Walt touches somebody else that goes to something we all know that we don't think about associating Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny together to tell Roger Rabbit. But I give Walt some credit for like, hey, he discovered Carl Stalling, got Carl Stalling really rolling in his career and working in animation. Who knows what Carl Stalling might have done had he not met Walt?
It's
would
like
he have
patchwork.
Ever done anything for animation?
It's like patchwork, you know?
It's patchwork. It's, it's the butterfly effect. You never know. Like Walt, sometimes these people, he only worked with Walt for just a little bit. But then when they go off and do these things, I always look back, it's like that time they interacted with Walt, how much influence did that have on their career?
Well, and also I want to say something else about Carl Stalling here. So the whole reason he ended up going to California, Walt just happened to stop by in Kansas City on the way between New York and California. He just stopped, you know, the train stopped in Kansas City, and he stopped by specifically to see Carl Stalling. And it was on that little you know, layover, you know, if you will, that he convinced him to come out there. So it was just it was a side part of a big bigger trip for Walt, mm-hmm. you know, but it was a huge impact for Carl Stalling.
Was that part of the same trip that he was developing Mickey Mouse on the way?
I don't believe it was the same trip. Okay. Walt made several trips to New York because at the time, that's where all the animation producers were
right.
and animation distributors. And so he made several trips between California and New York.
Yeah. Because the fun thing is, I call Mickey Mouse's hometown was Kansas City. Because while Walt had the Laugh-O-Gram Studios, he had a little field mouse that he caught in a drawer, and he taught it to do tricks and follow his pencil around. And so, of course, when he needs a character, I think that's probably why a mouse jumped in his head. Now, of course, he wanted to call it Mortimer.
Yeah.
Thank God Lily said Mortimer's a terrible name. Let's call him Mickey.
And he came back. Mortimer, the name, came back yep. later as one of the enemies.
Have you all seen that great cartoon, Mickey's Rival? Where you meet Mortimer Mouse, who's supposed to be like Minnie's old... I think they've re-released it even again. There's a yeah. They had a 90th anniversary of Mickey that had it on there. But they've recently... They've been releasing a lot of classics, and I think Mickey's Rival was on the first set that they re-released again. So if you haven't seen it, Mickey's Rival, it's a great one because Mortimer is just so this short jerk. And this is where we, you know, our lovable Mickey yeah, get to yeah. see him kind of just getting the bad end of things until finally... He gets to be the hero in the end. And that's why we love Mickey, because he's that optimistic little hero. He steps up when the time comes. And he's just this little hero mouse.
Well, something else about Mortimer, too, that I find interesting is the animators actually developed the look of him to be a caricature of Walt.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
He was the ornery version of Walt. Mickey had some of Walt's orneriness, but mostly his sweetness
yeah.
by
yeah.
the end. And then Mortimer was basically the mean part of Walt, if you want to call it mean part of Walt. More the ornery... You know, ornery version, we'll just say.
What's up?
I just looked up Mickey's Rivals on Disney Plus.
There you go. Go check it out when you get home
That's
today.
Right.
It is. It's a great cartoon.
Thank you.
Of course, we personally recommend the band concert if you've never seen that.
That's
one.
My favorite of all.
That's my number two because I love the Brave Little Taylor most of all.
It's stuck in my head that the music in there to this day. When I work out, believe it or not, I do. But I work out. I work out to that music. You know, all the music in there, and I have to have it together. It's got to all be together.
Yeah.
I love it.
All right, but we do have like Isidore Friz Freleng, which you mentioned before. You usually see him as either Friz Freleng on Looney Tunes or I Freleng. He actually was born August 21st, 1906, here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Wonderful.
He actually met Walt at the United Film Ad Service. Was that the first one he was working at or the second one?
That was the second one.
That was the second one. That's what I thought. He also met by works there, Hugh Harmon, and Hugh Harmon, who introduced Walt as Laugh-O-Gram, was ending. So now after Laugh-O-Gram, he did follow Walt over to Los Angeles in 1923, and then 7 months later, he worked on the Alice... Or no, I guess 7 months later, he followed Walt, and he worked on some of the Alice comedies and Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, and then he moved to New York with Margaret Winkler and Charles Mintz. Now, Walt... did not like any of his artists that Charles Mintz stole. He carried that. And Jim Corcus actually told me once when I was talking about this that when Walt would see I. Freeling on something, he used to refer to him as I.P. Freely. So you don't double-cross Walt. He was never going to forgive you, apparently. He was very passionate. They say he was temperamental, but it's like, that's not temper, that's passion. He was very passionate about his craft, and he wanted it right.
Yeah.
So he probably wasn't really mad at you unless you said you couldn't do it. Then he's like, I'm going to find somebody who can then. Mm-hmm. He was very passionate. Let's see. Any other things that we want to mention with Hugh Harmon? He is actually created and redesigned. Friz Freleng created or redesigned Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Yosemite Sam, Sylvester the Cat. Where it said Freleng was short, red-haired, and bad-tempered, which sounds a lot like... the name just went up. Yosemite Sam, thank you very much. Yeah. Also, Tweety Pie, who later became...
You didn't know that?
Yeah. But
you talked like halfway through and of iWorks. Didn't you say that he was the one that you said at your place there? Didn't you say that he helped to maybe redesign Mickey Mouse?
Yes. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. With going to of iWorks though, so of you know there's the you know again going back to the famous story of Walt losing all of his animators to Charles Mintz when he lost Oswald. The only animator that was loyal to Walt that stayed with him was of iWorks.
Mm-hmm. Of was awesome.
And Ub also Walt's first business partner. So Ub Iwerks actually had just an amazing work ethic and also an amazing talent. He was known for drawing, you know, thousands of animated cells a day, which, you know, people today can't do that, you know. And so Ub Iwerks was just insanely talented, insanely quick, and just a genius at, you know, anything he tried. There's a great documentary called The Man Behind the Mouse, The Hand Behind the Mouse, that his granddaughter, Leslie Iwerks, directed. Fantastic. Yeah, but yeah,
so, is that on Disney Plus? Anybody know?
I don't think that is. No,
I'm gonna go on YouTube, see if it's on there.
But Ub Iwerks, so Walt, you know, created the character of Mickey Mouse, mm-hmm. and then handed it over to Ub Iwerks to actually perfect the design for it. Mm-hmm. And those earliest Mickey Mouse cartoons, those black and white cartoons, those were really kind of Ub Iwerks' sense of humor, creeping in. And you know, if you look at those Mickey Mouse cartoons versus some of the later ones, mm-hmm. more specifically like the colored cartoons that come in later, Mickey is a little bit sweeter, a little bit more optimistic. Doesn't lose his temper as much as he does in those earlier ones. Those earlier ones, Ub really kind of put that spunk in Mickey that lost it later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ub was, you know, you talk about these people that, you know, we're talking about Frizz Freleng and how Walt had this little bit of a grudge maybe against him for leaving the studio. Yeah. The only person that really left the studio that Walt really welcomed back after they left was Ub Iwerks. So Ub Iwerks did end up leaving and created the Flip the Frog cartoons later on. And once those cartoons didn't do so well, Ub actually came back to the Walt Disney Studio, and in which case Walt was very happy to have him back.
Oh, sure.
Walt himself said that Ub Iwerks was the best animator he knew.
Yeah.
And Ub Iwerks actually, when he came back to the Disney Studio, did not want to come back as an animator. He wanted to come back as an effects guy. And so he actually ended up developing a lot of interesting techniques that they used later on. So Ub Iwerks was instrumental in the Xerox process, which is ended up how they ended up putting color on the films back in the day. They used to have the ink and paint department, and then they were able to just Xerox those copies into color forms. And so he came up with that. He also helped develop the what was at the time called Circorama, which is if you go to a Disney park and there's that 360 films that play. He developed the earliest version of that. So Ub Iwerks was just a technical genius. Later went on and worked for Alfred Hitchcock on a few films, nominated for an Academy Award for The Birds for the visual effects that he did for that.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Ub Iwerks is one of those guys that, we talk about how Walt was able to recognize talent in somebody and kind of encourage them to utilize their, undeveloped talent or those areas that they didn't know they had talent in. Ub Iwerks definitely that type of person, it's just like everything he did, he was talented at, and Walt was able to kind of bring that out of him, so.
Yeah,
he had the golden touch, you'd say.
And it is really amazing when you see some of the black and whites, the ornery rascal that Mickey Mouse started as. I personally kind of don't like the Parks version of Mickey because he's just too sanitized. I mean, I get why they do it. They want to have kids be able to come up and give him a hug. But it's like, this isn't the funny Mickey. This is boring that even a Boy Scout would say, you're a nerd. And not the good kind of nerd like us. I mean, he's just so sanitized.
Take it easy on Mickey, man. That's
I know.
Foul.
I love Mickey, but I love animated Mickey a lot more than I like sanitized Mickey. I did like some of those newer Mickey Mouse ones. They brought the rascal back a little
take
bit.
It easy on
and some of these
which
newer
that
ones.
Was that was part of the that was part of that incentive was to kind of
recapture
that old style.
And I liked it. That was fun. Still my favorite though is the I'd always get the name wrong, but the yodeling one that they did recently that's actually packaged with a Mickey's Christmas Carol on a Blu-ray. I absolutely love that one. Where he's trying to get it to Minnie Mouse is up on the top of a mountain, and like Mickey's being chased by this Yeti, and they're trying to not cause an avalanche. So it's like they have like a roar or scream, and they go, ah, oh, shh. And even when the Yeti falls off the mountain, he's going, ah, oh, shh. Trying to not have an, that just cracks me up. But I love that. It's like I love what they have in the animated. But yeah, in the parks, it's like, it's Clubhouse Mickey. It's like, well, great for the preschoolers, but for me, it's like, that's not the Mickey that's
still my
always
Mickey.
Entertain me.
My favorite Mickey is the early days of the color episode, whatever you want to call them, features, where he had just the circle, or you could call them oval, black
eyes without the slices.
Face. Yeah. Slightly flesh color for
that
you
vintage Mickey.
Love it. Love it. Love it.
There is one thing I do want to mention, though, while we still have Ub Iwerks, is he started working with, and some of you older folks might going to remember this, some of you maybe not, but in 1963 is when he founded DePatie Freleng. I don't know if you say DePatie or DePatie, with David H. DePatie. But if any of you are familiar with those names, you've heard of the Pink Panther, right? Those animated bits of Pink Panther. That's Freleng and DePatie, or DePatie Freleng. Like I said, I don't know how to say his name. But so, once again, there's another movie industry that, once again, influenced by Walt without him actually working on the project. So, Pink Panther.
And we mentioned MGM a while ago, the MGM stuff. They had some, we mentioned Tom and Jerry. Well, you could say they brought some people together because Tom and Jerry was created by Joseph Hanna and William Barbera. Mm-hmm. They would later on be kind of manipulated and taken advantage of by MGM themselves. And so they left that company and would go and start their own company called Hanna-Barbera. And as they did that, of course, MGM found that they could not really do it very well without them. Yes, we had Chuck Jones do a couple good ones and then some really bad ones without him.
Yeah.
And then later on, Hanna-Barbera got their cat and mouse back.
Yep.
So I'm glad about that. But now Warner Brothers.
Now they've got all of Hanna-Barbera, and I won't comment on what I think they're doing to the Hanna-Barbera characters. We'll just move on.
We won't talk about that. However,
I still love
Hanna-Barbera characters.
I have a weird note on Friz Freleng. He died May 26, 1995 in Los Angeles, and on that same day in Kansas City, I was graduating from Oak Park High School. Because I'm that old, folks. Okay, I'm going to skip over Cormac's Maximum, but Virginia Davis, I bet you got some stuff on Virginia Davis.
Yeah, so earlier we mentioned the Alice comedies. So the first, there was ultimately a few different girls that played Alice over the years, because after a while, kids
Virginia
do grow
Davis
up,
grows
you know,
up a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, kids do grow up, and so, in order to keep that kind of same type of energy, you have to recast.
Right.
Virginia Davis was an actress here in Kansas City. I believe she was only 4 years old the first time Walt saw her.
Wow.
But Walt, when he made his first Alice comedy, Alice's Wonderland, he cast Virginia Davis in this part. And he actually, sent that film reel to Margaret Winkler in New York and said, would this be something you would like to distribute for me? And she said, yes, on one condition, you have to have the same actress play Alice. And so Walt, much like these animators, convinced Virginia Davis and her family to move from Kansas City to California, where Virginia Davis continued to play the role of Alice for many years. And Virginia Davis actually, did some tests, audio tests, for a few other different Disney things later down the line. Like she tested for Snow White, and also a few voices in Pinocchio as well. But ultimately, Walt decided to go in a different direction with that. But Walt always kept her in mind and kept bringing her back to see if that was something that he could utilize her for.
Nice.
But Virginia Davis, she was the first Alice. Later on, they had a few other people play that. But Virginia Davis later on named a Disney legend. So she was the first. Female Disney legend name.
1988.
Mm-hmm.
Or although I did mention the Disney Legends website lists her as 1998, so I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, she's a Disney legend. I actually didn't realize I did have the note for the Snow White and Pinocchio. I had forgotten all about that. Wow, mm-hmm. Nice. But every time we talk about, and maybe it's just this time, this is the way my brain works. So Walt telling people to move to California, my brain says California is the place you ought to be. So they loaded up the truck and okay. I have a strange brain, okay? Sorry. Hey, you paid to see it. Okay, anyway. All right. Oh, we have a whole section on Love Iwerks. I feel like we've covered so much on him already. Wow. My goodness. But, oh, my gosh. Look, all these pages are just of Iwerks. So the amazing career that he had. And I think they even, didn't they keep his office somewhere in the studio?
Like I don't know about that.
I heard something about his daughter was actually getting to use.
His granddaughter, Leslie Iwerks.
Oh, okay.
So of Iwerks, he actually had a son, Don Iwerks, also Disney legend Don Iwerks. He's actually still alive to this day. Yeah, Don Iwerks and Ub Iwerks did effects animation together for many years. And then Don Iwerks' daughter, Leslie Iwerks, she herself is a documentarian.
Nice.
So she's actually a writer. She's written a few books. But she the first thing that she did was a documentary on her grandfather, Ub Iwerks. She actually did that on him because he passed away when she was only a year old. And so for her, that was a way that she could kind of get to know her grandfather a little bit. But since then, she's gone on to do a lot of work for Disney. She actually did The Imagineering Story, which is on Disney Plus.
Oh,
it's a fantastic series.
I still need to watch that.
Yeah, fantastic series. And then she also wrote a book, a companion piece, that kind of goes with that as well. And, but Leslie Iwerks, she's actually been a good friend of the museum and good friend of Kay, the executive director at the museum. So, she's done a lot of good work and a lot of good work in memory of her family.
Nice. It is kind of fun. Anybody remember Gabby Goat?
I do remember.
All right. So Gabby Goat, if you happen to see this, this is before Daffy Duck. Porky Pig used to have for his kind of partner in a lot of cartoons was Gabby Goat. And in 1937, actually, Leon Schlesinger Productions contracted Iwerks to produce four Looney Tunes, and this was the Porky Pig and Gabby Goat. Now, the funny thing is, some of these Porky Pig, Gabby Goat cartoons, you can see the exact same cartoon where they just swapped out and put Daffy Duck in place. But it was almost the same personality. Back when Daffy Duck was his early version where he was... Yeah, he was Daffy, and he was almost like an equivalent to Bugs, but I guess at some point, and it worked really well. They thought he would be better as a rival to Bugs Bunny instead of his own stuff. Now, I prefer like the early Daffy Duck where he would be, you know, having Elmer Fudd even as his foil when Elmer Fudd would go duck hunting. Those are hilarious. I love classic Daffy Duck, but I have to admit what Chuck Jones did with Daffy Duck when you pair him with Bugs Bunny and make him the foil of Bugs Bunny. I mean, come on. The whole rabbit season, duck season thing is just genius. But I don't know. A lot of the other times when people try to do stuff with Daffy Duck, it doesn't work for me as well as it did when Chuck Jones would do it. It's like Chuck Jones just had that way when he directed this stuff. And it's still my favorite bit of a Looney Tunes ever is when it's part of the rabbit season, duck season cartoon. And they're down in a hole. And Bugs goes to Daffy and he says, like, here, pick up out of the hole and see if he's still out there. Daffy pokes his head up, gets shot, you know, his body flies out. He comes out there, and his beak is all messed up, and is he still there? Still lurking about. Go check again. Not for me, I'm driving. I don't know why, but that is like my favorite Daffy Duck moment.
You're despicable.
He's giving me the sign that we got 6 minutes left.
Actually have a tie of Rabbit Season Ducks.
Oh,
I'm a pastor,
yes.
And so I have about 300 some odd ties. And I, every once in a while, just choose one for whatever reason, and I use that one quite a bit. Rabbit season, duck season.
Yeah. Oh, the Annie Awards. Anybody heard of the Annie Awards? Animation Awards. There we go. They actually created an award in the honor of UB iWorks. They call it the UB iWorks Award for Technical Achievement, which is awesome. And you mentioned, I guess, his son ended up working for Disney as well in the camera department, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
He was named a Disney legend in 1989, and I got an actual quote from him. He said, he told his sons, it doesn't make any difference who first drew Mickey Mouse. What made the difference is what Walt did with the character. So, because a lot of people want to credit, you know, really the version of Mickey that we got used to was Ub's, but Ub always, very humble of him for being the genius that he was, always gave credit. It's like, hey, what Walt did with the character is what made it special, not just his work, which is work. I mean, when you consider those early ones, oh, animated himself?
Yeah.
Stuff like, you know, Steamboat Willie or Plane Crazy. If you've never seen Plane Crazy, I love that one too. So I've actually got a Funko Pop of Mickey Mouse and Plane Crazy where he's trying to look like
Charles Lindbergh.
Yeah, and he goes and messes his hair up. He's got a mirror, and I got a Funko where he's got messing his hair up and looking in the mirror. I love it.
Technically before Steamboat Willie won it.
Yeah, so Plane Crazy was actually the first animated one that was completed, but it was completed as a silent film. And then when, obviously, sound came out, Walt said, well, obviously, we have to do a sound cartoon. And so they kind of put Plane Crazy over to the side, and while they were working on Steamboat Willie, that's when they incorporated the sound effects to it. And that's when Walt got Carl Stalling over to California was for that. But after the success of Steamboat Willie, then they released Plane Crazy after, and they also added sound effects to that as well.
Yep.
But yeah, Plane Crazy, that was the first Mickey Mouse cartoon that was completed, in which case UB iWorks did that pretty much by himself. He also did that pretty much in secret because at the time, Walt still had to finish a few of the Oswald cartoons.
Right.
And so Walt would have his animation staff that was about to leave him animate the Oswald stuff during the day, and then he would have, you know, UB iWorks come over, and at night they would work on the Mickey Mouse stuff in secret. So Plane Crazy, that was just as important as Steamboat Willie in many senses.
Yeah, and it's just as funny. And maybe it's actually funnier than Steamboat Willie. Steamboat Willie is almost like, look, we can make sound, let's play songs, and it's a delight. But when you watch Plane Crazy, and it's just funny.
Well, that was, you know, since that was the first time Mickey was ever drawn, he does have a little bit of a different style and personality in that than he does in anything else, even in Steamboat Willie. But yeah, that version of Mickey is different from any other Mickey you'll see.
Yeah, and it's good stuff. I don't know if you can find Plane Crazy on Disney Plus, but it has been released. I don't know if you can still get I think they call it Celebrating Mickey of the 90 Years Anniversary. They put out a Blu-ray, had a lot of some of just the best Mickey Mouse, including Lonesome Ghosts. Which is that's probably, I guess, my number three after his big the band concert. But it's one of the things I kind of feel bad for a lot of the generations after me is they, you know, Disney Channel wasn't showing a lot of these old cartoons, and I'm even a little disappointed. Disney Plus, I felt the promise of Disney Plus was I wanted every Mickey cartoon, every Donald Duck, and we got a handful. It's like, well, that's nice, I guess, but I wanted all of it. I mean, I don't mind they're making some new things. I mean, I'm behind on an episode of The Mandalorian, so nobody spoil it for me yet, please.
Oh, that's too bad. Oh, I'm kidding.
Don't you do it. I know where you live. I was your right here. So, I mean, there's a lot of good new stuff, but I'm just a fan of some of the classic. And, heck, if I don't have any kids. I have three cats. My wife and I weren't able to have any kids, but we love cats. And my cats don't understand Mickey Mouse. But I would love to have, like, kids to be able to pass on some of the classics of animation. And some of this you can still find. They don't really show a lot of even the old Looney Tunes or some of these old MGM cartoons. They're really getting to where they're hard to find, and it's really sad. But you put a little effort in. Some of this, I mean, it's better than a lot of what we see in computer. I mean, sure, it looks great, but there's just something about the hand-drawn that's just, it's magical.
That's why I buy them all. So that if I'm ever in the mood for the old stuff, I put it in.
There's just something so special.
You have to put it in? Yes, I have to put it in.
I was almost a reluctant convert into getting into digital movie because I liked having a physical copy of the disc, but once I got like my Vudu account and I realized, what does this code come with my Blu-ray here? I was like, oh, well, now I don't have to get up and actually grab the disc. So, but anyways, I got like 2 minutes, so I want to remind y'all to go to neverlandpodcast.com. You can find our website. We have a shop there where you can actually get this nice shirt and a lot of other new shirts that I'm putting in. Also, make sure you go visit Marceline and it's Hometown Museum. No, it's not that one.
It's the Walt Disney Hometown Museum.
WaltDisneyHometownMuseum.com.
The website is WaltDisneyMuseum.org.
Okay, WaltDisneyMuseum.org. And do not forget, on Sunday, I believe it's at 1:30, he won't be back. He's got to preach. So I'm playing hooky from church so I can be here to talk about Marceline, because Marceline, it's a magical place. It really is. And the influence that it had on Walt and even just those early childhood years, because, you know, you could say Walt kind of grew up in Marceline, but he also kind of grew up literally here. He learned imagination in Marceline. He learned hard work here because his father was rough. And imagine being as Walt was like, what, like 7 or 8 when they moved here? And
he was nine.
But still, he put him in a paper route. You know, because that's part of this paper route. So, I mean, it's really rough stuff. But, man, make sure you go visit and plan yourself. Go to the website, plan yourself a visit to the museum. Go into Marceline if you've never been. And, you know, explore a little bit around town. There is some Walt Disney history in here. We actually, in the parking garage, there was a nice little mural of Walt Disney as we were walking up. So there's a lot of amazing things. You can see his house. You can see the Laugh-O-Gram Studios. It's a really amazing history. And just think of all the different animations that a lot of us grew up with, and some of us maybe have missed out with. I don't know. In your generation, you might have missed a lot of these things. So there's wonderful, wonderful animation out there that actually Walt had an influence on, even if it's a small amount. You never know those little effects they have. So take that into the world. You never know the nice effects you might have on other people and what they may do because they interacted with you. So as I always say, with great power comes great responsibility. That's one of I live by that. That's why I'm such a Spider-Man fan. Whatever talent you have, as big or small as it is, share it. Because you never know what is going to domino effect. You can do wonderful, beautiful things. And always, as I always like to say, keep a pixie in your pocket. That was kind of our theme. That was keeping that little young of heart, happy attitude in your pocket that you could whip out and show it to anybody. And sometimes it just takes a handshake and a smile. Do something just nice for somebody. Just smile at them and say, hey, it's good to see you today. In fact, it's good to see y'all today. I'm so happy y'all came here. I was worried when I found out Margaret Carey was going to be behind it at the same time that, oh my gosh, I'm up against a Disney legend. Because there's one time I presented here that Jim Cummings was in the other room and I had nobody. Mm-hmm. So okay. I am so happy y'all are here. But thank you for coming. This was fun. Hopefully y'all learned something you're going to take with you.
God bless you all.
Yes, God bless. And hope to see you on Sunday.
Okay, so as we wrap up the show, I do want to, I kind of wish I'd run into him another time. There was actually 3 young ladies that sat in the front row at this one that I ran into actually on Saturday. They had come to see a panel with some Final Fantasy voices that had done Kingdom Hearts and also the Advent Children. And 2 of them were dressed up as Tifa and Aerith from Final Fantasy VII. And I didn't get a chance to get a photo of their costumes. They were really, really neat, but I appreciate them coming to the panel. And I kind of wish I'd gotten a photo because they were good costumes. But I was sitting in there also waiting for Elvira to come along. But it was really kind of cool. I was like, man, I wish I'd gotten their costumes because Aerith is like my favorite character out of there. And I did find some really nice artwork that I purchased of Aerith. It's a bit sad, though. It is where she, in the original game, of course, she does die. I'm hoping in the remake trilogy or whatever we're getting that they're going to find a way for her to live. And I had a conversation, actually, with the artist who had drawn this picture that I bought about that and what our hopes would be for that. Anyways, but Philip and I had a great time. I've got a lot more audio to be able to share over the next few episodes, including our second panel on that Sunday. So make sure you come back for that. And, of course, I've got audio from some of the celebrity panels with Jonathan Frakes and William Shatner and Cassandra Peterson. I sat in on a Bill Morrison panel that I did not record, but I did not realize. I wasn't sure what all he'd I heard he was a comic artist. I wasn't really sure what all he'd done, but he actually drew some Disney movie posters for like Bambi and Jungle Book and The Little Mermaid. He was getting to do some classic movies and some of the new movies as they were coming out at the time. So Oh, pardon me. I'm drinking a Dr. Pepper. So he came along and had a great panel, and I should have probably recorded that one as well. He's done a lot of work actually on the Simpsons comics with Matt Groening. So there is more to come. And of course, we want to remind you all to visit our website at neverlandpodcast.com. I should have my show notes up here to remind me where all everything was. I thought I had it on the internet, but that's right. It's not on the internet. It's on it's on the Google. But yeah, like Ricky Pope, who of course you hear on there, Darren Wilhite, all the people who helped me out with the introduction. Make sure you go to neverlandpodcast.com. Visit our shop. I got a brand new shirt line that I'm starting. The first one based upon the conversation I had with Phil Lawler on our last episode that love is equal to service. And how we can be more loving to other people. And I have a shirt that kind of represents that message and even a Bible verse to go with it. So doing kind of something different with our shirts on there. But yeah, I do appreciate when you go purchase shirts. I get a little bit out of those. I don't get most of the money from the shirts, but at least I get something and it does help out. So I would appreciate you going to do those. Make sure you tell your friends about the show. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. If I was looking at my show notes, I would have all the particulars about that. But if you look for Neverland Podcast on or even Neverland PCast on Twitter, you will find us on Instagram. On Instagram, I'm the Spider Pan. So yeah, go ahead and find us. We're on YouTube. We're everywhere. Make sure to rate us if you haven't already. My podcast reviews, you can find a link right there on the front page of the website. You can leave a review there. Also, if you happen to have a podcast and you would like to be able to collect your reviews from around the world, it's a really nice way to get everything. And please do leave reviews. I need to get some more. Even if there's something you don't like, let me know, but be nice, you know, because I can make improvements. If I know that there's something that people don't like, then I can make changes. So, yeah. I'm really just fumbling for words here, so I'm just going to wrap this up with the way we end our show, which I didn't want to end the panels this way, because I don't know if people would understand when I say get lost. In an adventure! All right, so come back next week and the next few weeks, because I'm going to have a lot more content, and I hope to collaborate with some other podcasters I met while I was there, and I made contact with some interesting people while I was there that may come on the show. So, well, I'll just leave it at that. Okay, now I'm going to get lost.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.